There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hello and welcome back to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. My name is Ben Pfeiffer, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Max Carlin. Max, how's it going?
I'm doing well, Ben. How are you?
I'm good. And today, we have part two of our discussion with TJ Farrick, Swarthmore assistant coach, about player development as it relates to evaluation and the draft. And we talked a lot about player development and stuff last week, and we're going to talk about more about how it relates to evaluation. So I actually forgot to introduce TJ. So TJ, how's it going?
Good. Happy to be back.
Yeah, back as in we all left the room briefly and came back. But it's a couple days for all of you listeners. So without rambling too much, let's get into it.
There is no shortage of action going on with our partners over at betonline.ag. The sports world is slowly making its way back with the NBA announcing its return in late July. But right now, UFC, boxing, NASCAR, and international soccer have all resumed play, and BetOnline has the best odds / lines for their best upcoming games and matches. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC happening live every day for our devout gamblers to check out. BetOnline also offers hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, and the best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag on your computer or mobile device and join now to receive your welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online wagering experts.
So in part one, we talked a lot about just broad strokes, player development, coaching. But now we're going to apply it a little bit more to directly to prospect evaluation. So one other thing that kind of bothers me most in draft evaluation is that it really is like a snapshot in time evaluation where for the most part, people are looking at 1 year of play from these prospects. And I mean, we talked so much in part one about how so much of a prospect's outcome is player development. It's not the evaluation aspect. So the most obvious thing that you would look at when trying to project future player development would be past player development. So I guess when you're looking not necessarily from a draft perspective, TJ, but from a coaching perspective, like how important is it to you to look at a player's past development in order to guide how you develop them going forward?
I'm not really sure of the answer to that, but I do want to talk a little bit about Ja Morant here, because I think he's one of the more fascinating stories in American player development over the last, I don't know, 6 years or whatever. Kind of his developmental arc being so much off the grid and in many ways, when I researched him a little bit and found out how his dad basically went about it. And that was a fascinating case study to figure out how he developed into who he is today. And then to think about what is going to happen with him going forward, I guess. But what was the question again?
I know. Just take it down the jaw road if you want. I don't know. My question is, it's not important. Go ahead with the jaw story.
So Ja Morant, Ja Morant in ninth grade played on I think this is a fairly well-known story, right? So played in an AAU team with Zion Williamson, and they both said they were role players on the team. Or maybe that was eighth grade, and there was a guy who was like a top-ranked eighth grade guard or something like that on the team. He kind of got all the shots and stuff. And so That's one kind of point. There's another story about Ja Morant that I think a lot of people maybe don't know, is that Ja Morant, he has a full court in his backyard, and his dad was a Division II player, and his dad basically was his quote-unquote trainer for a lot of times, and I think probably like guided a lot of his decisions. But in Ja Morant's backyard, he talks about in a few ESPN articles about him and the kids from the neighborhood just kind of like coming together and just playing basketball when they were young, right? So like, just instead of like, he would train with his dad and stuff, but just like being in the backyard playing 3-on-3, playing 4-on-4 in the summers, and just playing basketball a lot. And so when you look at Ja Morant as what he became at Murray State and what he was, I think you see a lot of that in his game. Like, he just looks like a dude who is hooped a lot. And so that's one point. And then another point with him is that, so his ninth grade season, he took the summer off from AAU to simply train with his dad. And his dad not only does training in like the, in a traditional sense, like basketball training, like coming off of ball screens, dribbling, finishing, but he also does a lot of explosive, plyometric training, tire jumps, and then adding challenge and that and stuff. So he took his entire ninth grade season off. His 10th grade year, his coach wanted him to be on the varsity team, and he told the coach that he didn't want to be on varsity. He wanted to be on JV. And so he played his entire 10th grade year on JV, because I would assume he would have the ball in his hands and he would have to make the decisions and do the things and have the responsibilities rather than maybe being the 6th or 7th man on varsity. And then he kind of took off his 11th grade year, but still didn't play. He played for, I think, for a circuit team, but also for like a smaller AAU team. And then everyone knows the story about how they found him in the back gym playing 3-on-3 at a showcase event. So I don't really know what all that says, but he's a very fascinating case study in terms of player development, being off the grid and also making unorthodox decisions to prioritize having the ball and having responsibility. I just think that he's, and then becoming, what was he, the second pick?
Second pick, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of a real world illustration of the thing that we talked about in part one with throwing a guy into the G League, where it seems like Ja, at all of these different turns, put himself in a position where he would be getting on-ball reps and seeing a lot of basketball and developing that pattern recognition that, you know, ends up being what we call basketball intelligence or feel or whatever it may be. So it seems like he's a real world illustration of that, which is really cool. I think probably an important case study. And I mean, it gets to the point you mentioned with Kobe, like the real developmental story that comes from Kobe is not staying, you know, getting up at 5 a.m. to be in the gym. It's playing 400 NBA games by the time you're 23.
Or playing, you know, probably 4 years of high school where he had the ball in his hand all the time, And maybe you, and me, and I think it's, I'm not saying it's not Kobe's story that he was up at 5 a.m. because by all accounts, he was up at 5 a.m. in high school in the gym, but there were so many game reps involved in that, in between the age of 14 and 22, that it boggles the mind to think how much live basketball Kobe Bryant might've played in that time.
Or Ben, you can go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to quickly point out, I think it's fascinating, like how much that first of all, that story specifically is like ingrained into basketball culture. And I'm sure like how much that weighs on like young kids, especially like coming up now. And then like relating that to, you know, like to Ja Morant and the AAU circuit, which has become very like popularized and like kind of done in a certain way with these kids coming up through high schools and then going to, you know, these powerhouse AAU teams, playing like tons of games in a short span, and then, you know, playing, you know, a lot of players rather play for powerhouse high schools or, you know, go to schools like Montverde or Patrick School or IMG to, you know, play there. But like Ja Morant didn't kind of ascribe to that and went about it differently and, you know, wasn't, it's kind of like straight away from like mainstream basketball culture in terms of the track of guys going from high school to college to NBA. So I wonder like how fixable something like so deep rooted in like not just like player development is not just player development trends, you know, as we're talking about at the college and the NBA level, but, you know, in these players' ideas of like what basketball is and like how to be and like how you are supposed to go about being good at basketball, you know, from a really young age, and, you know, like how we teach these things. So
I think that's essentially, yeah, what I'm kind of getting at is like both of those, like both the basketball culture thing, and I'll come back to that in a second, because I don't think it's, people are always like, oh, it's bad, or Montverde and IMG and AAU. Like, I think a lot of people in my world, at least, are like, have a derisive attitude towards those things, and I don't. But the Kobe mythology, I think, is very real with young kids, and it's harped upon all the time. And that's what I heard coming up as a player, is you got to be out there in the snow and the wind and the rain by yourself, putting in the work. And that's perhaps partially true. But the real truth is that it is that, and more so playing basketball, getting live reps, playing live games. Like when I was a player, I never ended up being a good player, but I played Division III. I was a bad player on a bad team. But when I was putting in hours and hours of individual work back in the day by myself and not playing basketball, because I thought the individual work was like the thing to do, because that's what everyone said, right? But it's that's not it. And then the basketball academy thing we can get to in a second, but I think that like that's an individual decision. Like Jalen Duren, you guys know Jalen Duren?
Yeah.
So like Jalen Duren's a Philly kid, or he was playing in the Philadelphia Catholic League, and like really high level basketball in the Philadelphia Catholic League. Jalen Duren needs to be at Montverde Academy, like in order to develop into the player that, you know, he can be.
Yeah. No, I remember watching like Oscar Tshiebwe last year playing in whatever like poor high school conference he was playing in.
Catholic or yeah.
Yeah, it was just, Giannis. I mean, yeah, he really did. He really did look like Giannis. And so yeah, I think that, you know, getting a good level of competition is important. I mean, and it's, yeah, you kind of need like the balance of the two things, where you both need these decision-making reps. Not necessarily on-ball reps, I guess, but you need these decision-making reps where you're actually taxed, but you also need a competition level that's going to put you in a situation where, like, you can't afford to make bad decisions and just compensate for it anyway with, say, shot-making or something like that. So you need a balance of those things. But this idea of, like, putting yourself in position to get on-ball reps, like, it is very interesting to me, especially with the younger guys. And like, I think emphasizes the need for multiple contexts that we talk about so much, because I think about someone like Reese Beekman, who I know Ben, like you've noted this before, that with Phenom U, like, or maybe Ross noted it, but with Phenom U, like, does not play a very central role, but then with this high school team is like a pretty ball dominant guy. And it's just like getting those multiple contexts, I think, like, it allows you, or like, I would think, I guess, it allows you to apply these like skills that you learn to a different role in a way that like might project forward very differently. So I guess like to turn that into a question, like TJ, how much do you think that like trying different roles is very important for a player in order to develop different skill sets that will coalesce in, you know, one role and make them better at that role?
Right, dude, that is such an interesting question, man. I don't have an answer to it. But that's definitely something that I've thought a lot about. And I'll use an example of another Philly kid, Sam Sassum. Sam played at Shipley, so we played against him a lot when I was at Penn Charter. And so I saw him play like at least once a year, probably like 8 times throughout high school, maybe 10 times throughout high school. And so I knew his game pretty well, and he was always on the ball. And then he went to Binghamton. He scored 1,000 points in 2 years at Binghamton. He's been training at Penn State. I did an evaluation of him by myself, just because I was trying something out. But he's so dominant on the ball, and he's always just been on the ball. And so when he gets to Penn State, it's going to be interesting to see, like, how is he going? Is he going to be able to thrive in any way, or not thrive, but even like exist off the ball in a meaningful way? And so that'll be interesting. But like that question is so interesting to me. Like, if a kid is a primary creator for his high school team, should he also be a primary creator for his club team, or should he perhaps have like a secondary creator role so that he can meld into one complete player or whatever it is? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, just like logically, and you know, thinking about what we talked about in part one a lot. I mean, it makes sense that, you know, having different stimuli and different challenges, you know, makes you a better player, and you know, makes your brain more, you know, reactive to different situations. I mean, the example I like to think of is Scotty Barnes, who with his AAU team with Knight Riders is on the ball every possession, and you know, effectively plays point guard, and you know, he's very good at it. I mean, in AAU, he's an awesome basketball player in that setting. But then when he goes to Montverde, he is in a completely complementary role, playing next to Cade Cunningham off the ball, and that's likely going to be more analogous to what he ends up doing in the NBA. But I mean, just because that's the truth, I don't think that means like it's more important. I mean, we talk about how important primary creation is, and how difficult therefore primary creation is, because you know, it's a difficult skill to find, and guys who are legitimate, you know, offensive drivers are rare. But that doesn't mean, you know, it isn't any more difficult than playing in, you know, an off-ball role for a guy who has primary created for so long. I mean, TJ talks about, you know, the Binghamton player who has done primary creation his whole time. But I mean, if I would wager that he would struggle pretty mightily off the ball, because it's just a different context that your brain hasn't seen before. You know, like, which is what a reason like, you know, Scotty, I think, is a good example, because he's excelled in both of these roles. And I think that bodes really well for his future. Because I mean, let's say, I mean, even if you run, like, is, you know, running a high pick and roll is theoretically more taxing and more difficult than attacking a closeout. But I mean, if you've run, you know, thousands of pick and rolls, and of course, all pick and rolls are different. But if, like, let's say Scotty Barnes spends a whole summer with his AAU team running high pick and rolls and running high pick and rolls, and then he goes to you know, Montverde, and he has to do a totally different thing. He's attacking closeouts, he's playing in the post, he's setting screens, he's making plays up the short roll. I mean, yes, I mean, making attacking closeout is technically less difficult than maybe executing a complex pick and roll read, but it's a different stimulus that your brain has to adapt to and that you have to execute. And I think, you know, just thinking about it from that lens makes it, I mean, again, I don't have any like empirical data or research to back up what I'm saying, but just logically it makes sense that, you know, guys who are able to succeed in like at lots of different basketball, you know, actions and in lots of different environments, you know, that seems like a positive indicator, at least to me, I would assume.
One of the things though that I would say, I don't want to say a counterpoint, but there are things that transfer between roles that are not necessarily the same thing that you're doing in a given role. So the example I'd give is like, say you've got a 6'5 player who at lower levels is an on-ball creator. And like TJ was talking about earlier, like it's very good to be a hop shooter because you can get into, you know, you can get into that shot in all these weird contexts. So this 6'5 initiator has lots of experience getting into his shot as a hop shooter off the dribble in, you know, like weird context. He's contorting his body, like he's moving in different directions. So this player gets to a higher level now, and now they're an off-ball player, and you have them running off screens. Like now this player who's spent, say, his entire life working as an on-ball player and has like really cultivated his pull-up shooting, well, now he's shooting off movement, and he's got the ability to hop into shots, to contort his body in different ways, to like approach from all these different angles and get a shot off. And I would say that while that's a very, very different thing, there are transferable skills there that have made this player well suited to the role. I don't know how that factors into this whole discussion, but I do think that it's like a counterpoint to the idea that a guy needs to necessarily play different roles, because I do think that simply by playing basketball, you'll develop skills that transfer like to other, you know, ways of playing basketball.
Right. And this is where I bring it back to practice a little bit. Like team practice, I think is a really valuable area where guys can experiment in different roles. You can experiment with guys in different roles. So you can, and I'll use Penchard's team right now as an example. We have two guys who are ninth graders who are both really good on ball. Like, you know, like they're young guards, right? They played with the ball in their hands. And I think that the practice environment is one where you can say, okay, 5-minute scrimmage, you're going to be on the ball, you're going to be off the ball, and then we'll swap, right? So, like, I think that's how I would maybe approach it in development. Sorry, Ben, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I didn't have an important point. Just kind of to add to what Max is saying. I mean, I'm just curious, like fundamentally from a brain reaction standpoint. I mean, how much? Yes, I mean obviously like those skills are like very transferable. I mean, hopping into a shot and being able to contort your body works. You know, are necessary skills for a successful pull up shooting and for a successful off movement shooting. But I mean, there are like different components of that. Those actions, I mean, like gathering off of a dribble versus sprinting into a catch and shoot, you know, are fundamentally different like movements for your body. And you know, I'm curious about, you know, less about like the specific movement translating and more just like about having different movements, you know, like a different like we've talked about, you know, making sure like, you know, you talked about, you know, having a drill where the player fails 40% of the time, you know, having a different challenge for, you know, for the body and for the brain, something they just like haven't seen before, and you know, adapting to that challenge, like, about how much that really matters and like how much that helps to development.
Right. And I would bring this back now to what I think I've cited him earlier. I'm sure I did. Brian McCormick says there are three different parts to skill. There's movement, there's perceptual, and there's conceptual. And I think we move now from, when we're talking about different roles, I think we've moved now from movement, but like we've moved to the conceptual realm, I think, here. So what we're talking about is like, if you are a primary creator, can you play off the ball and adapt to someone's drive, like, and react to someone's drive? Or are you just kind of like, you're sitting in the corner and your man's helping down and you're just continuing to sit in the corner and not shaking up? You know, like that's something that needs, that's a conceptual thing that needs to be learned through live game reps in a different role. You know, like anyone can use that kind of like, let's say a side pick and roll, right? If you're very used to using a side pick and roll and you've never played in the ball side corner, you won't automatically know to shake up when your guy helps in on the roll, right? So that's something that you need to develop through live game reps in that alternative role.
Yeah, and I mean, along with that, you could say that if you get a chance to then, you know, play in the ball side corner and you have to like lift up to the wing or whatever, now you might better understand that when you're running that pick and roll, that that's where the shooter is going to be for you to kick to or something like that. Like that sort of thing where it's a like a touch concept, and it kind of leads into like something I wanted to ask you about is like, have you noticed any touch skills? Like something that we, I think, specifically have talked about is Kyra Lewis being so smooth transitioning from dribble to pass, and how we think that kind of bodes well for his pull up shooting, because I mean like physically it's a fairly similar thing to do, right? You're transitioning a dribble by gathering it, and then you're you know, executing some other action, and you're doing all this again while reacting to and processing various stimuli. So like, have you noticed in your coaching any things that you consider to be touch skills?
That's a really good question. That's I think, again, one that you guys probably have a way better idea than I do. Like, that was just through your evaluative lens, like how is Kyra Lewis as a pull-up shooter right now?
He's pretty good. I think he's not yet at a point where he's willing to launch them probably as much as he should. One of the reasons that he struggles in isolation is not just that he like doesn't really have a lot of shake as a ball handler, but that guys don't necessarily respect his pull up that much and will sag off of him a little bit. And then once you're doing that, like, since he's not that deceptive, you can like, I don't want to say you can move with Kyra Lewis, but he's like, he's a little predictable. And I think that's part of why he's struggled as an isolation scorer. But I think, I don't know. And I think that it's just like, I'm curious. The reason I asked you is because I feel like it's something that like just through years, like on the ground working with players, like you start to realize, okay, like kids who have this trait also like seem to possess another one. And I can't prove that they're related, but it certainly seems like they could be.
Right. No. Yeah. I think that's something I'll definitely look at. Like, I don't know though. And my years on the ground, like I had 8 years on the ground where I was like not looking at anything the right way, and I've had two where I think I've been looking at it the right way. So it's all a real work in progress. Ben, go ahead. My bad.
Yeah, and just another example. I mean, like people often conflate like passing feel and team defense feel, you know, and in terms of, like, which are two things that like it, like logically make sense that they'd be connected. You know, from a fundamental point, it's being able to read actions, whether you have the ball or whether you don't have the ball. You know, I mean, obviously, I mean, the motor skills within those are different because, you know, one, you have to dribble and gather and, you know, flick your wrist or make a pass. And the other ones, you're, you know, moving laterally or, you know, flipping your hips or getting vertical at the rim to make a rotation. But I mean, like, I think a lot of it, I'm not really sure, but obviously I don't know. I don't have an answer to this. I think a lot of it, like, it's just like skills are so interconnected, and like talking about isolated skills like is difficult because like every skill like is connected, and every skill has so many other skills, you know, attached to it. So
right.
I think like
I was saying when you say so the thing that you're talking about is like if you have good feel and you have quick processing as a passer, that should logically translate to your feel on the defensive end to as a help defender.
I mean, I would understand those to be touch skills. However, I think the problem is when you work in the other direction. So like, I think the really good example would be like Vassell this year, brilliant feel as a defensive player, like brilliant help defender, but not a wildly impressive offensive decision maker. And I think there are a few things at play there. Lack of advantage creation, lack of handling ability to you know, put himself in the, like lacking technical ability to execute the decisions that he would be capable of making mentally, and then also just roll what they want players to do at FSU. But I think I think working in the opposite direction is a little more interesting, where like if you're not encumbered by those technical abilities on offense, and so on offense you're able to execute all of these things, you should logically be able to do it on defense also. And so I think you see that with LaMelo, I think is a great example of that. And I think that you do see that like feel, instincts, whatever, are touch skills because LaMelo has those. But the problem is when you get into more things that I think are closer on the spectrum to technical ability. So like LaMelo, amazing court awareness, like really like preternatural court awareness, where he and like Nikola Jokic are the two guys alive who will catch, you know, a defensive rebound, and before they've hit the ground, before they've turned around, are in the process of throwing an outlet 80 feet. So he has this unreal court awareness. However, he gets slammed by screens and seems to have no clue like where a screen is coming from. And you'd think, right, that he has like some amazing court awareness and can apply that on defense as well, but it doesn't seem like he does. And so like there are all these divisions, I guess, within even what like logically you'd think would be a touch skill. And parsing that out obviously is huge for projection, because we're trying to isolate things and you know, figure out what translates to a higher level, what will hinder you at a higher level. And so I think there are these great questions where you're trying to make inferences about prospects and, you know, how they think the game and how they approach the game. And you can't really, you're left doing a lot of guesswork and like the conclusions don't really line up.
Right. I think the Kyra example is a much more solid footing than the one where it's like, if he's a good passer, then he'll maybe be a good defender or whatever. Like, I think that because the Kyra thing is so movement based, like it just seems like if there's fluidity and movement and that processing speed is there in the passing, then why won't there also be in the shoot, like, you know, in the shooting? Whereas the LaMelo is a great example of that, where his court awareness offensively is second to none almost. Right. And yet defensively it just isn't there right now. So I think that this is something you guys have thought about way more than I have. So, but I would be more inclined to like believe in the Kyra one more than the, because the guy is a good passer and has good offensive feel. He'll have good defensive feel.
Yeah. But
and I think, go ahead, Ben.
With LaMelo, I think a lot of it comes out, I mean, to like, kind of like in-game reps on both ends, as we've talked about. Because, I mean, throughout like his entire like basketball life, he's been, I mean, since eighth grade or whatever, I mean, even before that, I mean, he's showed like flashes and glimpses and of this incredible offensive court awareness and this incredible ability to, you know, to see the whole floor and to execute passes, you know, as early as like 10th grade when he was running the show at Chino Hills. But then, I mean, up until like this season with Cairns, I mean, he's like never been asked to defend a ball screen in his life. I mean, because it's like at Chino Hills, they full court pressed the whole game. And at Spire, I mean, at Spire, he just kind of stood on the block and swiped on defense. And like you almost never saw him playing actual like NBA defense. And we're at Cairns in the NBA, in the NBL.
Illawarra.
Oh, that was a silly mistake of mine. Illawarra. I don't know why I thought Cairns. Yeah. With Illawarra, I mean, he had just never had to play actually, I mean, it was the first time, excuse me, he had to actually play, you know, basketball defense in terms of, you know, defending ball screens and, you know, doing things like that. And I like, even though like logically he should be like aware of where players are coming from, that's just like not a thing he's had to deal, like he's had to adapt his court awareness to. So I think, you know, this is, you know, just a hypothesis that, you know, I think it's certainly a teachable thing in time. You know, I just like bringing this to like an evaluative perspective is like a reason I'm pretty positive on LaMelo. I have number one, I think defensive improvement is tenable with him because he has this baseline court awareness, like this spatial awareness and sense of space and positioning that you see on offense, but then like he just hasn't had the reps as a ball screen defender to understand the angles at which ball screens come and how to evade those ball screens. And like, and I think, you know, obviously like this, it's going to be fascinating to track how he improves defensively, you know, and, you know, how he fares in his NBA career. I mean, like, you know, the idea is like, you know, as he sees more ball screens, you know, hopefully like some of that awareness can adapt and, you know, make that more viable. So.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about like fascinating case studies. I think LaMelo is definitely up there because I think you're spot on. Like if you apply the talk that we've, you know, had about the games approach to LaMelo, like he truly just hasn't seen game reps as a defensive player. Like he didn't play defense, like anything resembling actual defense at Chino Hills. At Spire, it was like marginally more real, but not really. And then with Illawarra, like he's playing defense for a professional basketball team that is trying to win games. So I think that there's definitely like potential that LaMelo's growth on the defensive end could be exponential in a way that we've never seen before, because you're talking about like an all-time intellect who has none of the technical ability, but if he starts being put in positions where he's forced to develop that technical ability and it catches up enough to the intellectual ability, that you could see growth on the defensive end that's absolutely enormous and like unprecedented, just because we don't have an example of a guy this smart but also this unrefined. So yeah, it's going to be a really interesting case study.
Yeah, actually, now that you both said that, like I said, you guys have thought about this a lot more. I'm very convinced of that argument. That is,
but I think the
part about Kyrie, but I'm not very convinced. But I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes total sense that he would.
Yeah, I mean, the problem though is that there are confounding things like effort, like
and
he
strength.
Still,
right. Yeah.
Yeah, and strength. Yes, and strength, and the fact that maybe it's too late for him to learn the technical abilities, or. Like, or maybe it'll take so many reps for him to get the two in sync that, you know, he'll be 30 by the time that, you know, he's capable, like physically of acting upon his intellect. So there are a lot of like confounding elements there, but I think there's definitely a legitimate argument to be made for the idea that like we could see unprecedented growth from him on that end. Yeah. from like truly like basically never having played defense to high level NBA defender. Should we get into some of the talk about resources for learning about player development now?
Definitely. Yeah, I would love to. Let me preface this by saying, I'm going back 2 years now to May 2018 or the June 2018 when I first kind of really started like saying, all right, I want to coach basketball for the rest of my life. And I don't know anything about player development, or I thought I did, but I don't. And now I need to start looking into that. And so everything that I've learned along the way, and I want to be really clear about this because I may be speaking very authoritatively right now. Everything that I've learned, I've taken from someone else, literally everything. And so what I've I've taken from someone else and I've perhaps adapted it in some way. And I think I do want to talk a little bit about learning and what that actually looks like versus what people think it looks like. But basically what I tried to do is I found something that was convincing, this theory of the games approach, this theory of random practice. I found something that through that I thought was convincing, and then I sought out people who I thought really knew what they were talking about. And I studied those people, and then I tried to implement what they were telling me to do in what I was doing. And so these are some of the people that I started with. The two guys that I started with, well, the first guy that I started with was Brian McCormick. And he was to me essential because he understanding the conceptual underpinnings of the games approach. That's what his books are all about. And he's actually recently transitioned into talking to writing a lot more about shooting. And so Brian is at Brian McCormick on Twitter, and he's 180 shooter on Twitter as well. And I would definitely encourage people to look at 180 shooter, for just maybe some unconventional approaches to thinking about shooting. And I would also encourage people to buy I own a few of Brian's books on player development. So that was the first guy, and he is I don't know if he's the godfather of player of a games approach or something, but he's certainly the first guy that I had ever heard of talking about that, Brian McCormick. And then the second guy is Chris Oliver, and I've talked a lot about him. And he's on Twitter. He is Basketball Immersion. And he is a guy who I think in 5 years will be doing whatever he wants to be doing in the game. I really have the highest regard for him. And he has been the most important person in my professional journey probably in the last 2 years. And I've literally never met him or talked to him in person. I think he may know who I am, but I've just been studying him and trying to implement his stuff. So Brian McCormick, Chris Oliver, those are the two kind of conceptual places where I started. And then from there, I found a bunch of other guys who I thought were really good. One of them is Mike Dunn. Mike Dunn he's most accessible on Instagram, and he's actually in South Jersey. So I've had the opportunity to go see him, do a workout, and he's a shooting coach. And so I would just follow him on Instagram. I'm not really going to go in anymore on what Mike is all about, but he's different. He's very entertaining, but I've never seen someone shoot the ball in, like, you see it on Instagram, right? And it's like, oh, well, yeah, it's just like, whatever. This dude in person is incredible. I've never seen someone shoot the ball like him, and he's a great teacher of it. So that's the third guy. And then his mentor is a guy named Rob Fodor, and he's at The Shooting Guy on Instagram. And Rob is, he's the shooting coach for the Miami Heat. So I would follow him as well. He has a lot of really good content.
Yeah. So we'll put out a tweet with I don't know, all these people's ats, because I mean, they're invaluable resources when it comes to learning about player development. You had a few more?
Yeah. I just have one or two more. The one guy who I think is really, really, really good is a guy named Matt Pugh, and he is actually based in Missouri, I believe. He's a Midwestern guy, and I've talked to him a little bit throughout the years, both on Twitter and then over the phone about – he has a 3-on-3 development league also, which I'm super interested in trying to develop over here in Philly. And he is just a tremendous teacher of the game, Matt Pugh. He's probably at Matt Pugh on Twitter. And
Ben and I will have to try to track him down somewhere in Missouri. if we're ever back in the state of Missouri.
Large state of Missouri. And then Dakota Webb is another guy too. And they both used to be with Pure Sweat. I don't know if they're both with Pure Sweat anymore, but they're both tremendous teachers of the game and guys who are definitely worth a follow.
There is no shortage of action going on with our partners over at betonline.ag. The sports world is slowly making its way back with the NBA announcing its return in late July. But right now, UFC, boxing, NASCAR, and international soccer have all resumed play, and BetOnline has the best odds / lines for their best upcoming games and matches. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC happening live every day for our devout gamblers to check out. BetOnline also offers hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, and the best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag on your computer or mobile device and join now to receive your welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online wagering experts.
Oh no!
Those are the screams I used to make when I would cut myself shaving before I knew about Manscaped. Thank you, Manscaped, for turning my loud shrieks into multiple peaks. Men, start taking notes because Manscaped accidents are finally a thing of the past. The Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0 has been beautifully designed to reduce those painful nicks and tugs. This is their third generation trimmer, featuring advanced skin-safe technology so you keep your bad boys nice and smooth. When I tell you this is premium, I mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes so you can take a longer shave. The water-resistant technology allows you to shave in the shower too. One of the coolest features is the LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for closer and more precise trimming. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code armchair at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code armchair. Your balls will thank you.
Now TJ, did you have a few questions that you wanted to flip onto us and you know, take the role of podcast host and put us on the spot?
Too many questions for you guys. All right, so
we got time.
Do you guys want to start with the PD question about skill development, or do we want to start with maybe some of the easier questions that I just have about draft and terminology, and then
let's start with those.
The PD one seems like a longer conversation.
Yeah, let's do the easy ones first.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. All right. So let's start with and this is just like me scouring draft Twitter because I think I told both of you guys, but one of the reasons that I gravitate toward draft Twitter is because I think that people on draft Twitter are committed to doing good work. And I see that with you guys. I see that with Ross and with Zach and with your whole kind of cohort or whatever you might – informal cohort or whatever you might call it.
Friends of the program, yeah.
Okay. And so a very simple question. The tier system, how does that work?
I got it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, a straight numerical big board is inherently flawed because, you know, all it tells you is like player one is better than player two, who is better than player three. And that lacks nuance inherently. So like, I mean, ranking within tiers, I mean, tells you, let's say, I mean, player two is a little bit worse than player one, but significantly better than player three. Ranking those guys just 1, 2, 3 doesn't tell you a lot then. So that's why that's another, tier demarcation. I mean, let's just give an example. You have a class, a class of prospects that has Cade Cunningham and Zion Williamson as your 1-2 and then other guys. I mean, those guys are going to be head and shoulders above everyone else. So ranking like someone third who's head and shoulders below can be disingenuous because, I mean, there's such a massive gap. I mean, and it's just, I'll use the word nuanced lot, but just, gives, a deeper way to look at these kind of prospects because, I mean, player two on the board is going to be further from player 10 or 15 than player 50 is from player 100. I mean, that's just historically looking at how draft talent shakes out. I mean, the guys at the top, there's such a wider separation than the guys at the bottom. Just looking historically at who ends up panning out in these drafts. See, that's kind of like a rough roundabout way of explaining, how I do tiers, why I and so many others end up doing tiers. So.
I think they can, the way people use them can vary a lot person to person, which is why I think it's like very important that you remove the ambiguity that can be there and explain what your tiers mean. So last year, what I said in like my primer for my big board was that within tiers, I was receptive to any argument of ordering, but the order within was my personal order. But I think that for this, like going forward, that my revision of that would be that tiers for me are like logical groupings of like not necessarily archetypes but of sort of like draft gambles or like what you're aiming to acquire and that I could even see between tiers arguments for people so like I guess the example I'll give to explain that because I'm imagining that's not super clear is that, like, I have Leandro Bolmaro in a tier above Grant Riller. And that's because I think that Bolmaro has, like, a more realistic chance of being, like, a really high-level team offense driver on account of really buying him a lot more as a decision maker, as, like, a field guy, as a guy who also just, like, doesn't limit you as a team builder if he achieves a high-end outcome because he is so valuable on both ends. However, like, I don't necessarily think that there's anything wrong with a person saying that they would rather have Grant Riller, who you're very confident in as a scoring prospect, over Leandro Bolmaro. I think it's a very, very reasonable standpoint to adopt. However, like, in these groupings where I think the thing that Bolmaro represents is a lot more valuable, that's going to be in a higher order grouping for me. So I think that that's how my tiers are evolving, that they're value groupings, the way I see it, but I'm receptive to, you know, to arguments otherwise. However, I might end up just reverting to my old system and make larger tiers, especially this year. Like, I think you would have, like, if your approach to tiers is I can see any order within this tier, I think this year you would just have huge tiers. So I might revert to that. But as of right now, I'm thinking of, like, a value grouping of, like, what I'm trying to acquire with, like, at a given spot, and that's how my tiers are organized right now.
Yeah, and I think there's some, I mean, especially as you go down the board, I mean, even at the very top, there's some archetypal delineation, as, you know, in most drafts, the guys at the top of your board are going to be guys who you believe are primary creator, or potential primary creators, as those guys are the most difficult to find and the most important commodity. And even going lower, I mean, in the tier that, like, spans from, like, the end of my first round to, like, middle second, I have lots of wings, and then below that I will have more of the guards and more of the bigs, because generally just, like, wings are, you know, are more important and more difficult to find, especially, like, guys who can play on rookie contracts, as, you know, those guys are tough to find, whereas, you know, fringy, you know, scoring guards like I think of someone like Jared Butler, who I'd have a lot lower, because, you know, Jared Butler's talented, but you can find, you know, a scoring guard in, you know, the Adriatic on, like, quite a few teams. So that's just, like, there's some archetypal, you know, evaluation, but of course, I mean, that varies, and you can't just, like, ascribe archetypes directly to value, but there is some importance there of positional scarcity. So.
Well, but what I think,
yeah, I mean, you can, like, that's what kind of
could,
what,
yeah,
that's what I was asking, like, because I think that I, like, big boards to me, like I said, that with my example earlier about, like, who's, I had to rank 50 players that I scouted over 4 games, and, like, I spent, like, 15 minutes deciding if Abbon Gilder should be above Ryan Klein, like, at number 45. Like, what am I doing? Right? They're in the same tier, right? So, like, that's why I've always gravitated towards the tier system. But I was just wondering about the guys are explaining right now, the delineations between tiers.
Yeah, I think the larger point, though, with like, a thorough interrogation of the tier system of big boards in general, is kind of how silly a general big board is. And this is something that a friend of the program, Zach Milner, has talked about a lot, especially with relation to this class, which is just so context dependent, which is something that, like, so many of our episodes have really kind of hinged upon, is how context dependent this class is, that a general big board is kind of silly in the absence of, like, a Zion, and then, you know, clear players who are clearly behind them, and then have clear delineations between those players. Like, it's kind of a silly concept, because, like, if I'm a team that wants to play a drop, like, I'm not going to draft Obi Toppin very highly at all. Like, it just doesn't work. Or if I'm a team that, like, is looking for, like, a creator, I'm not going to be drafting Denny highly. Like, I'm not going to be drafting Tyrese Haliburton highly. But if I'm the Toronto Raptors and I have a top 5 pick, like, maybe I am considering Tyrese Haliburton, because, you know, he can slide in there. If I'm the Milwaukee Bucks, where you've got, like, two superstar level creators on your team already, like, maybe I'm considering Haliburton really, really highly. But, you know, if I'm the Knicks, that's not factoring into my equation until way, way later in the draft. Right. So I think that, like, general big boards are kind of, I think they can be supplanted to an extent by a tier system where you're like, all right, it's going to vary on a team by team basis within these tiers, but these tiers are going to stay relatively fixed. So I think that's another like point of utility for tiers to sort of replace big boards, which while like they drive clicks and interest and people really want like an ordinal ranking or whatever it is, like people really, really want that, but it's really not the best way to go about this. Like I personally, I don't really care if I had, you know, Cam Reddish 12th or 10th. I care more about like understanding in advance why he succeeds or fails.
Yeah.
And if I can do that, like I can make a case for or against a player, it's just, you know, it's a lot more, it lends a lot more like nuance to a situation that is very nuanced. Like it's not just, okay, this is the best player on my board and I have to then be a slave to that board and take that player and that's a good pick or that's a bad pick. No, like there's a lot more to this than that.
Right. And that's why I've always like, I've like kind of like I'm insinuating. I think the big boards are like, what is this? And I've always found mocks to be more, you know, mocks based on whatever the current like draft order is to be more interesting than a big board for sure. Because like you're thinking about fit, you're thinking about if they're playing drop coverage or not. Like they're not going to draft Obi Toppin. And then so the tier system was, like you said, kind of supplanting was kind of the thing that I guess I had in mind, but also the qualification of what each tier means. And then I guess the spinoff question for that was like, and Ben, I think you kind of addressed this, was why aren't there more tiers within the second round?
Yeah, and I think that's just because, you know, looking historically, the drop off in talent as you go lower in the draft is massive. And there's a guy named Jay-Z Maslish, former Steppian draft writer, isn't around anymore, but is someone who like shaped my philosophy quite a bit as I was coming up. You know, he has a piece that I'd recommend, you know, UTJ could read, and you know, everybody who's listening who's interested reads, you know, about the talent curve and about tiers, and just, you know, there's such little difference at the end. You know, I mean, I'm sure you know on Prep the Pro at some point you talked about how, you know, after pick 45, you know, it really matters less, because like just looking at historical hit rates, it's so much harder, you know, to separate guys between, you know, guy 50 and prospect 100 on your board. As you know, the difference between like Zion, let's say the difference between LaMelo and like, at least for me and for Max, I know the difference between like LaMelo and Tyrese Halliburton is significant, is very significant, and yet there are a lot fewer spots. And let's say like, I don't know, like on my board, someone like Colby Ross and Jared Butler might be 40 spots apart, yet the separation between them is almost nothing in reality. It's not meaningful, which is why, you know, like let's say I have Colby Ross at 90 and I have Jared Butler at like 60. Like if you argued that you Colby Ross is a better prospect, I'm like, fine. It's not a meaningful difference. So I mean, that's why, you know, as I go down, you know, these, because, you know, I mean, like being like a good NBA player is like really difficult, and you know, I feel like a lot of myself included, I have like overcomplicate like scouting a lot of lower level guys, because like at some point these guys have to be really good if they're going to be like good NBA players, because you know, it's you know, very few of these guys actually reach that peak. You know, with a lot of the lower level guys who are going to end up, you know, being Euro players or being longtime G League players anyways, or maybe like two way guys at some point. There's just not a lot of separation. So that was a really long winded answer, but hopefully that you'll be able to add some clarification.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I do tier well into the second round.
Yeah.
But I stop tiering when I don't think guys are NBA players anymore, because at that point, agreed. to me, it's all the same tier. If I don't think I don't think you have a realistic shot to be an NBA player. Right. So like, I'll tier the difference between like Sadiq Bey and Najee Marshall. I've got Sadiq Bey in like the mid 30s and Najee Marshall in the like late 40s. I'll tier the difference between that. But when we're talking like Jamias Ramsey and Jay Scrub, like I don't think either one of them is really an NBA player, so I'm not going to tier.
Max is going to piss a lot of people off.
I'm just going to have a final tier that's guys I don't think are NBA NBA players. But yeah, I'll tier as long as I think that there are meaningful enough differences that I don't really see a case for ranking one guy above another. I'll tier them. Right. Or as long as I see, you know, like value differences that are significant enough that I think they deserve to be grouped differently. Like I'll keep tiering.
Gotcha. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. And then I had a question. Well, I have some stats questions about use of stats, but let's just go to terminology real quick. Cause I think these are quick knockout ones. So point of attack D, does this just mean on ball defense?
Oh yeah. On ball, but I mean, I'm thinking like usually like ball screen. Situations, yeah. But yeah. Yeah. Like
on ball screen. Yeah.
Okay. So like point of attack could be like simply guarding someone who's trying to break you down at the dribble one-on-one, or it could mean an actual like guardian ball action. Guardian,
yes.
Ball screen, dribble handoff.
Like not
but off I would. Defense. Yeah, and I wouldn't consider like closeout defense to be point of attack defense.
Right, right. Gotcha.
Just like yeah.
Okay. All right, jumbo wing.
Just a large wing player who's like a wing forward sized. I think that I don't know if we've just used the term jumbo wing, but
jumbo creator, maybe.
Like jumbo wing initiator.
Yeah, exactly. The term, at least the way I've used it, should be jumbo initiator, where it's an oversized creator.
That was my
bad. So think you're Giannis, like Luka types. Yeah, LeBron.
Right, jumbo initiator was the one you guys were using in the one with PD.
Yeah. Then it was definitely in reference to jumbo initiator. Yeah. I mean, I think big wing is a different thing where I think of like someone like Paul George, who's like a legit 6'10". There's a difference between that and like Jaylen Brown, who's also a wing player, but is like 6'6". So like I think there's a big difference there. And I would refer to like a Paul George or I guess Kevin Durant as like a big wing. But yeah, jumbo initiator is like a LeBron, Luka, Giannis.
Yeah.
And then secondary creator. So I think these are all like things that I think I know what you're talking about, but I gotta make sure. Yeah. Like secondary creator versus primary creator. Like
Yeah, I mean, to someone who's, you know, maybe not good enough or just isn't able to, you know, be the guy who carries a significant, like the major offensive load. I mean, it's probably easier to like think of this in the inverse. You know, primary creators are these ball dominant players like Luka or Trae Young in the NBA or LeBron, or I mean like Michael Jordan going back. You know secondary, you know, talk about secondary creators, maybe players who can't command like a 30 usage and can't run offense every single time, and maybe are guys who can't be the primary driver of offense on like a very good team, but can be a complement to that guy. You know, maybe they're lacking in burst, so they're best optimized. You know,
like would it be like
secondarily?
Like who? Like is it like a Cam Reddish could be a potential secondary creator? Like if we think about even the Hawks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Cam Reddish, Kevin Herter. I mean, I tend to think of someone who's attacking a defense that's already been put in rotation to some degree and then can make plays off of that. Or it can, or like, you know, another part of that role would be to, like, you know, if the whatever the primary object of a play design is, you know, after that fails, then we can resort to, you know, doing something with this guy. But I tend to think of like, about attacking something that's already been like an advantage that's already been created, and then they can make plays off of that, but you're not the one who's like offering the genesis of the advantage creation.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, at least in terms of like this draft, we think of someone as like Tyrese Maxey, as someone who like isn't going to like necessarily be able to tilt the defense consistently by himself, but someone who's going to, you know, be able to attack a tilted defense regularly because of, you know, his ability to attack on the catch.
Right. Like Tyrese Maxey isn't breaking guys down off the dribble, but like if a pass is kicked to him out of a pick and roll and he like gets to attack a closeout, then he can make like a simple kick out of that. He can get to the rim and finish. He take a one dribble pull up, but like he's not the guy who's running 20 pick and rolls a game.
That's a guy, correct me if I'm wrong, with Tyrese Maxey, because I haven't watched a ton of these guys. Like I said, like I've watched, I think Sadiq Bey, I've watched a lot of Miles McBride, who's not
the guy. Yes.
Yeah, we'll talk to him in a second. But correct me if I'm wrong about Tyrese Maxey, he's a guy who's going to be really interesting to watch with regards to the question we had earlier about different roles and how they might meld together. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, he played on the ball
his whole life.
The time, pretty much.
Yeah,
high school, AAU. He played FIBA as well, right?
Yeah, ben? He did, but he wasn't really. Yeah, FIBA was the time where he was off ball a lot next to, I mean, Cole Anthony, I believe, was the main guy on that team.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, he, like, I don't think he played as much in FIBA. I mean, FIBA compared to, you know, high school and AAU as well. So.
Right.
But well, yeah, no, he's definitely
he's been on the ball, but he's also going to now have to be not so much on the ball, right?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a case of that. I think it's interesting because I think in his Schmitz like film room thing, he did mention that he was trying to learn how to play off the ball, and it was really uncomfortable for him. And you see all these things that like used to be part of his game, like for example the shooting, that just kind of vanished this year, because I think he was just a lot less comfortable, and he just didn't have experience playing that role. I think that, you know, comes into play, and there's also just issues of variance in a small sample size, but. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think with him, maybe it'll be less melding into another role and more that just like how much of his primary creator skills that he had in high school and AAU can he bring to a more secondary role, which is what I think he just will be in the NBA. But we could I think there are definitely scenarios where Tyrese Maxey winds up at a level where he is a combo guard of sorts, where he is doing a lot off the ball, but also is playing on the ball more than your average like two guard, I guess, essentially. Yeah. In which case, yeah, I think it would be the melding of like he has to learn how to be a good off ball player, and then can also bring in these skills that he's always been honing as an on ball player.
Mm-hmm. All right, can we talk some stats real quick?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so I want to start with the true shooting. Metric. What is everyone's infatuation with true shooting as a gauge of like overall shooting skill? And even like I read one article, I think it was an Athletic article, where the guy was like, if you don't have an over 50% true shooting, I'm not going to consider you like top tier or something like that. And so like,
yeah, Lamella, I mean, it just that stuff is ridiculous. I mean,
like lazy.
It is. I mean, in true shooting, I'll say true shooting is an important tool in terms of like in terms of, you know, evaluating whether or not an NBA player is good, and less about prospects.
Well, not good, but not good. Efficient scoring. Efficient in their scoring. Role.
Yeah. And again, role is key because true shooting requires a lot of context. I mean, even beyond talking about like relative true shooting, you know, adjusting to league average that year, guys in a higher usage role are, you know, going to take on lower true shooting more often. I mean, you talk about a guy who's like 60 true shooting with like a 10 usage, and people will swoon over that, when in reality it's, you know, that's a lot less useful than a guy who's like maybe like 52, 53 and 30 usage. I mean, obviously again, context is important, but that's the general gist. And you know, as a prospect, you know, there's so many, you know, variables to shooting development. Like, as we talked about plenty, you know, it's a really difficult thing to do. You know, and there's so many like volume and like touch and free throws and versatility that go into it. That, you know, using just like putting like LaMelo's true shooting was not very good this year. Sure. Like, but like citing that as like the reason he's not going to shoot.
Objective tool. Like, it's just like, yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, it's just not a thing that you can do. I mean, there's no historical basis in like projecting like guys who had like high true shooting to the NBA. I mean, like Marcus Howard has like an incredible true shooting percentage. Right. He's likely not going to be an NBA player for like a lot of reasons. I mean, and LaMelo obviously will be. So.
And then, yeah. So yeah, I didn't really want to go too deep into that, but I was just like, it just seems like a lot of laziness and not wanting to watch film.
Can I do a quick true shooting spiel? Because
yeah, for sure.
Okay, so yeah, anyone who's anyone who's using true shooting as like a measure of shooting ability, like jump shooting ability, yeah, like I wouldn't even listen to that. That's insane. Like, have fun making the case that Udoka Azubuike is a good shooting prospect. But the reason I've come to hate true shooting. And like in the context of true shooting is like, I would much rather see that than field goal percentage, holistic field goal percentage, I guess, or I'd rather see E field goal than field goal percentage. Like any alternative to field goal percentage basically is good. But the reason I've come to hate true shooting is because it does not account at all for role. So you have people citing true shooting, and it's like the NBA Twitterification of like all basketball discourse to a point that's like really bad, because the only like true shitting is not the only thing that matters. It like tells you how efficient someone is in their role, but roles have like vastly varying degrees of difficulty. Like James Harden putting up 60 true shooting with the largest usage ever, not to mention that like his isolation load is historic. Like, it's totally unprecedented. That is very different from like Ed Davis putting up 60 true shooting on 12% usage in 12 minutes a game. Like, they're not remotely the same thing. And then the other reason I hate true shooting is because of historical comparisons. People use true shooting and they'll say, these are the only seasons with 28 plus points per 100 and 60 plus true shooting in NBA history. And it's like Steph Curry, Isaiah Thomas, Michael Jordan. And it's like, yeah, well, I wonder what these people have in common. It's like two of the greatest scorers of all time and one guy who happened to play in the last 5 years and was, yes, very, very, very good. But like Isaiah Thomas is not one of the three greatest scorers of all time. So the lack of historical context on true shooting when it's used to compare guys across era, I think is really bad. However, what Basketball Reference has just added is a
adjusted shooting
tab. Which has it's scaled to 100, I think. So every point above or below 100 would be one percentage point better or worse than league average, which I think is a very useful thing to have. I don't know if you can query that yet in Play Index, but that's a really nice thing to have. And they don't yet have it for Sports Reference, so not relevant to prospects. But that's my like soapbox thing on true shooting. Don't just use it to compare guys across different roles. What we should be doing is, at the very least, you should be looking at efficiencies in play types and then weighting those play types according to league average in those play types, which I believe is what Mike Savagno and Jackson Frank did. But it was just for a snapshot in time that was not a live updating thing. A live updating version of that would be very useful, though.
Right. Or just like kind of back to my original issue is, or just watch the tape. Like, if you're trying to project shooting, like, watch the guy shoot a lot, which is for me to say, I have synergy, but like, and that was my next question, just like rolling over into synergy efficiency data. And Sadiq Bey would be and you guys talked about this. Sadiq Bey was probably one of the guys, like him and Miles McBride, and I guess maybe David Mitchell, the three guys who I've looked at like pretty closely. And again, Davion Mitchell and Miles McBride aren't in this class, but I looked at Sadiq Bey because everyone was like, oh, secondary creator, because of his, simply based on his 98% PNR efficiency from Synergy. And like you guys have said this on previous pods with PD and in PD's breakdown of Sadiq Bey, said the same thing, is that it's not there.
No. Zero advantage creation whatsoever.
It's not there. And the idea of him as a passer, like, is a nice one. But if you just think about the context of Villanova, where he's coming from, and you watch the tape, like, those are all pre-programmed reads for the most part. It's not any kind of, like, processing creativity. And, like, I really like him as a player. Like, I think he'll be okay. But I think that – I just think that, like, I like analytics and stats and things like that, but – those things like that are just such a malfunction of what stats are supposed to do. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like synergy numbers very much. I it's a nice novelty to have, but realistically, I should probably just stop paying for the stats. But like the only, like, it's useful when you look at very specific things, I think, which is something that's good about Draft Twitter, is that a lot of guys, when they're using synergy stats, they are using it very specifically. So I know like Zach will cite a lot of times like spot up no dribble jumpers to get an idea of what kind of like an off the catch shooter a guy is. And that's a valuable thing to look at, or to look at like how often a guy is getting to the rim out of ISO pick and roll, and maybe spot ups if you want to throw that in.
Those are really valuable to me, I think. I think
Mike Gribanov is the one who really does a lot of that.
Yeah.
But using very specific things from synergy, great. I think looking at play type frequencies to me is useful because it gives you an idea.
I think frequency is more important than the efficiency to me. I mean.
Yeah. It can give you an actual insights into a player, whereas like you can see that like Desmond Bane, like, play type wise plays very similarly to like Ty Jerome and Landry Shamet. Now you probably like based on the comps that you're going to see from like the Ringer, like you're going to think that Desmond Bane plays like Eric Gordon and Marcus Smart. And that couldn't be further from the truth. But looking at synergy play type, just distributions, like you'll get a pretty good idea that he actually plays like one of these guys that weighs under 200 pounds. And is like a college creator.
Right. He just looks like a linebacker. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have much to add.
Yeah. I have a million other things that I could ask, but do you guys want to touch on this? Go back to the skill development question just real quick.
Yeah. The one that PD posed, when he was on. Yeah. Just reiterate what that question is.
Yeah. So the question that PD asked was, which of these skills is most changeable? And I think I got that word right. Shooting, playmaking, tools being movement or like weight gain or like strength, dribbling, feel, and defense. Those are the.
I guess my answer to this question would be that I refuse to answer it because the categories have to be broken down so much more and clarified to a point that like the question completely changes. Because like by defense, do you mean like defending ball screens? Because like provided you have like not outlier lateral movement ability in either direction, like you and you aren't like stiff as an absolute board, like if you're a guy who like never even gets into a defensive stance and like doesn't have the footwork to get over a ball screen, like I feel like for the most part that can be pretty like can be developed pretty easily, like we see with Killian Hayes in the past year that he went from like bottom of the barrel to like close to elite in that regard. But when you're talking, if by defense you mean, you know, making the like feel plays that Xavier Tillman does at like tagging, you know, cutters and rotating at the rim and just like doing these things that he has just like built up the pattern recognition to do over like probably hundreds of thousands of hours of playing basketball, I think that that's impossible to develop. And then, I mean, the thing that like, I know we had talked about handling, like, do you mean protecting the ball enough so that you don't get stripped when you're attacking a closeout? Or do you mean becoming Kyrie Irving? Because I don't think becoming Kyrie Irving is remotely possible. But, you know, becoming Jaylen Brown where you can, like, get to the rim without someone stripping you, like, I think that's pretty possible. So I think that this question just has to be, like, made so much more specific to the point that it's like you're asking a different question.
Right. Because, I think to your point, like, well, yeah, go ahead, Ben. Sorry, but I agree with you, but yeah. I'm
pretty much agree. Like I think like my answer for both of these, like could be like playmaking feel. Like again, like he said, like becoming Kyrie Irving is possible. Like becoming Chris Paul, becoming Steve Nash, becoming Luka Doncic, in like that being so manipulative and brilliant as a playmaker, I don't think is really possible. But like becoming a guy who can make a kick to the corner off of a short roll, or like Max said earlier, I mean, kick to the weak side of corner in the pick and roll, I think is very teachable as like learn reads in certain situations. Like you say, okay, like we talked about this in the past. Like, I mean, like we talked about this with, I think, Onyeka Okongwu, but it applies to any pick really. I mean, on the short roll, you say if the corner's open, you pass to the corner. If not, you try to go finish. And like you can teach that, you can drill it in. But again, I think that's something that like we've seen like happen a lot in the NBA. But I don't think like we really ever see guys going from like that to a preternatural passer or decision maker or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what my answer to this question is either. I think the answer, kind of Ben, to your point, is that like all of these skills are intertwined to such a degree that it's so hard to really answer. But I think it's worth me as a coach considering just in a more simplified version, because like it's like, all right, so what, how do I identify an attack then? You know what I mean?
What's worth your time to, exactly. You know, what's worth the time and resources that you have that are limited? You know, what should you
try to improve?
Yeah, I mean,
and for me, like the question that I ask myself and I've asked myself and tried to ask others is like, what is the most important skill for a player to have? And through time, I've basically come to answer that I've come up with is shooting. is in a way, and I don't feel that strongly about that, but like if you can shoot, you can be on the floor. How many dudes are on the floor because they can shoot the ball, or on a team because they can shoot the ball? And if they shoot, they wouldn't be anywhere close to the floor. So that's what I try to like go after a little bit. And in addition to everything else, of course.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely true. But my problem with that from like an evaluating prospects and trying to acquire scarce resources thing, it is if shooting is the most malleable skill, which I think we all agree that it probably is among these. Like shooting really can be improved. I mean, you can go from being Blake Griffin early in his career to Blake Griffin late in his career. Like you're talking about transition from non-shooter to like best big man shooter in the league who is like shooting a high volume of pull-up threes. Like if you had showed that to me as like a, however, I don't know, like 14-year-old watching young Blake Griffin, I would have thought that, you know, this is, it's like not real. But you can't do that with other stuff. So if you're talking about like a mind like Xavier Tillman's or like Tyrese Haliburton's, like you can't get that elsewhere. You can't just teach that. So if that's the, if shooting is the thing that's like the most important thing to have, but also the easiest to teach, then like unless like the shooting is an absolute lock, this is kind of how I approach it. So like Neesmith has significant value just because like the shooting is a lock. Like he's a very, very good shooter. But when you're talking about a guy who's like a pretty good shooter and that's his only appeal, so think like AJ Lawson or Jamias Ramsey, like a guy who's really only appeal is as a pretty good shooter. Like if I think I can teach someone to get to Jamias Ramsey's level as a shooter, then I would just so much rather have the guy who has the things that I can't teach.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm with him.
Yeah. I was, as an evaluator, I totally agree with you. As a coach, I'm like, all right, let's kind of try to teach you.
Yeah. Cause as a coach, right, you just want to get a guy to a point where like he can play for you.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I know we're running up against time here. Can I just end on one note real quick?
Oh yeah. We can go as long as you want. Right. We have plenty of time.
Yeah. Because I think there are just a few kind of like, again, I've been on this journey, so to speak, for 2 years. One of the most important things to me, and this is kind of stemming from partially from PD's introduction to Wings. He talks about a lot of this stuff or this general philosophy about how we all talk about basketball and how we all talk about players and things like that. And one of the most important underlying things for me in my life and my career and my like pursuit of this is that I'm doing this because I love to do it, right? Obviously, like you guys do this because you love to do it. This is what makes me feel most fulfilled. But at the end of the day, all of these conversations and all of these things, like the game is about the players, full stop. And that's kind of what I try to, what has guided me through a lot of this is like, hey, I'm doing this. I decided to do this and delve into coaching because I found that it is what made me most fulfilled. But B, in doing so, I try to keep top of mind at all times that the game is about the players and not about the fans or the coaches or the evaluators or the scouts or the TV people on TV. It's the game's about the players, and that's, I just kind of wanted to end on that note, just to not end on the note, but that's something that I've always try to keep in mind for the last 2 years or so.
Following the senseless murders of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and countless other Black community members at the hands of police officers, we want to ensure that we do what we can to make a tangible impact on those communities as we grow. Armchair Media will be issuing 4 $500 scholarships per semester to aspiring Black creatives. If you've ever been dismissed as having an unrealistic career path, if you ever butted heads with parents or teachers because they don't recognize exactly what you want to do with your life, if you have feared to express yourself or put your work into the world due to potential backlash, we strongly encourage you to apply. We recognize that there are creatives out there who may have bypassed college to pursue other avenues, who didn't get into college because their passions didn't translate to collegiate testing, or who did not have access to the financial means to pay for college. This is why there are only 3 requirements for eligibility. Black creative, under the age of 21, and you submit a project: graphic design, photography, writing, audio video, journalism, creative writing, to scholarship@armchairallamericans.com. That's scholarship at armchairallamericans.com.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's especially poignant right now that basketball is about basketball players.
Yeah.
All right, but should we get into briefly some catching eye guys?
Yeah,
then?
We can go quickly. I'll go with my guy, Eric Gaines, who is a 2021 draft candidate. It was actually, you know, surprisingly relevant to our conversation. I didn't plan this, but you know, I'll get into, you know, he's just 6'3". He's really good player, a good prospect in my opinion. 6'3", skinny guard. Pretty wild shot making flashes and handling flashes, super bursty, really tight ball control, flexible with the ball, can do all of the moves, get to the rim. And then defensively, he has some like incredible instincts and makes some ridiculous plays, you know, as a help defender. And then like, is just always moving, has a crazy energy. But then like, the things with him, I mean, he is a pretty baffling decision maker on offense and on both ends. And besides being real thin, that's the issue with him. And the reason I think he's relevant to this conversation is he's another guy who is, you know, an off the grid kind of development type. As I mean, he played for, I can't think of what his school is at this point, but it's a small school in, I think it's Lithonia. Lithonia, Georgia, a small school where he was pretty under recruited. He played only three games, I think three or four games with Team United at EYBL before an injury. So he hasn't really like had a spotlight, and his development's been very off the rails. And you know, I think Mike Gribanoff said this in like a group chat that he plays like he's never been coached, and like that's really true. Like he plays off like all instinct, and like he's gonna get the Ja Morant comparisons because of, you know, the athleticism and the handle and just the frame in general. I was talking with PD. I kind of like, he kind of agreed that I kind of think of him as like good Ashton Hagens, as Hagens as a guy who like plays purely off instincts and like doesn't really have, you know, kind of like doesn't seem like he has a lot of rhyme or reason to what he's doing. And Gaines is similar, but you know, unlike Hagens, he can, you know, dribble, and he's very good at dribbling and shot making. So just another guy who I'm fascinated to see. I should mention he's going to LSU next year to play with them, and I'm fascinated to see how he ends up at the college level. And I think he could be a guy who really rises throughout the year and throughout as people like begin to see like how talented he truly is. So
that's another thing that we could do an entire episode on, is guys who do seemingly play off of instinct without like basketball experience. Of course, LaMelo is a huge example of that, but I'm now thinking of like the multi-sport guys who are kind of late to basketball, or anyone who's late to basketball in general. But the multi-sport guys, like there's Miles McBride, who was a big time football player, I think, until I don't know, very late in his high school career, and Jalen Suggs, who was a three-star recruit as a quarterback, is in next year's class, as of right now is going to Gonzaga, and is a pretty brilliant basketball player. But yeah, these multi-sport guys, where I think like there are probably like, I don't want to say touch skills, but in terms of like just spatial awareness, I think there probably are like crossover points between playing football and playing basketball. Like I think that there are probably like certain patterns that you start to recognize, or just like, yeah, an awareness of what's around you that is influenced by that. So that's a fascinating developmental conversation that I don't know that any of us are qualified to have. But yeah, the late to basketball thing is really interesting, and I think there are a lot of like different philosophical views on that, and like not a lot of empirical evidence and like, yeah, it's a really interesting topic. I don't know if you guys have anything to add before I go on to my
one thing. This is Chris Oliver.
Yeah, go ahead.
He always says is that basketball is a late development sport, right? So whereas golf, let's take golf as an example. Golf, like if you look at Rory McIlroy swinging a club when he was 3 years old, like he had that, right? He had what he has now, he had back then. But basketball is a late development sport, and I think it can also be an early development sport, but you see players like this all the time, kind of to your point, Ben and Max.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a sport where lots of weird things happen with development, especially because you're talking about like, yes, football players are total physical outliers, but they're not like height outliers. Like they're for the most part are like normal sized human beings height wise. Now they're not normal sized in terms of like, you know, the muscle volume that they have and that sort of stuff. But basketball players, you're talking about guys that like pretty much by definition have to undergo like a ridiculous outlier growth spurt that like does something to the human body that's like pretty abnormal and weird. So I think you see like really weird development and really weird arcs of skill development. Like Jason Tatum comes to mind because like watching him in Peach Jam as like a 6 foot six guard who's like a really, really competent pick and roll operator is very, very different from watching Jason Tatum as like a 6'8" freshman at Duke who's like a power forward. And then I don't think it's a coincidence that then by the time Jason Tatum is like really understands how to use his body again, by the time he's like a second or third year player in the NBA, that all of a sudden you have this 6'10" ball handler who is, you know, maybe the one of the great wing pull-up shooters that we've ever seen. Because he had, he had this weird acclimation process and like, I don't want to say skill regression, but like skill derailment. Because like you can see, I think he had a huge growth spurt, I think between his junior and senior years of high school where he like very visibly grew, and you see things like his handle getting looser, like something that has kind of remained a problem even to this day, but he like maintains the moves and like deception in space that he has a 6'6" guard. So I think that sort of thing is unique to basketball because of the way that that guys develop physically, and is also like drives home the importance of watching guys across multiple years. Because like, if you don't do that, you miss that 6'6", 16-year-old Jason Tatum was like a big time pick and roll ball handler. He wasn't just like a post up and ISO 4 at Duke.
Yeah. I had no idea that before you were like started posting videos of that on Twitter, I was like, wait, what? He could do this? Cause I do. Right. And then,
yeah. When we're done, I'll send you a couple links to like old Jason Tatum games that I found, but it's really interesting.
Yeah.
So my one catching eye guy is Killian Tilly. So Killian Tilly has had a rough go of it with injuries, obviously, and has lost a lot of the movement that made him special. But he still is like positionally, I think, really, really mobile. And he's such a brilliant feel and intelligence guy. He's such a brilliant touch guy. Like, you hit Killian Tilly on the roll, and like from 17 feet, that runner is money. I have the numbers here. He's over his 4 years, 31 of 58 on runners, according to Synergy, which is it's over 50%. It's really good. That number seems too low. I think he had more runners than that, honestly. But like crazy, crazy touch guy. And it's like such a brilliant passer, like such a quick decision maker. Defensively, it's not just he has the movement, but he has the intelligence. He's a great communicator. He processes things so quickly. So just a brilliant mind, like wonderfully skilled. I mean, I didn't even talk about the shot at all. That's so quick that like is legitimately versatile for a guy who's 6'9", 6'10". Like he can shoot in a lot of different scenarios. He can shoot off the dribble, off movement, off a pick and pop, off spot up. Like the guy is so wildly skilled, so intelligent. If he stays healthy, I mean, he's a good NBA player. Like it's,
yeah.
And at that point, like, you got to draft him like pretty high, I think. Even if you think you're going to get a year of healthy Killian Tilly, like, it's the same argument as Jonte. It's like, if this is the 37th pick or something like that, like who cares if I get a year out of him? If this is a year of good NBA play, like that's worth the 37th pick. Like you have people trading first round picks to get Marcus Morris for half a season, and he's not even good. Like it's just, I think it's pretty obvious that Killian Tilly,
yeah,
like unless you have 100% confidence that he is like never gonna play in the NBA, you should draft him like fairly high.
Yeah. All right, I think that's kind of all we have. We could talk for forever, but I mean, yeah, at some point we have to
talk about a pot of Miles McBride. That's that.
Oh, there will definitely be a Deuce McBride pod at some point in the future. I can promise that. So yeah, I mean, thank you so much.
Just rename the entire podcast the Deuce McBride podcast.
Yeah, like name our podcast after him, name our children after him. I mean. lots of deuces in the Prep to Pro family. So yeah, with that, thank you so much to TJ for coming on. Again, you can follow him at TJ Farrick on Twitter, right? Just yep. Your name. Yeah. Again, follow the pod at Prep Number Two Pro Pod. Follow Max at Max A. Carlin. You can follow me at Ben _ Pfeiffer _. And unless anybody has anything else to say, I think we're going to cut it. All right.
Have me on, guys.
Of course. Have a nice day.